You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, I'm Will Schwalbe, and you're listening to But That's Another Story. Sometimes, when I'm stuck with writing, I'll spend endless hours on the internet reading what other writers do when they've got writer's block. It makes me feel like I'm handling the problem when, in reality, I'm really just wasting time. Other times, when I hit the wall, I'll find myself doing anything and everything I can to procrastinate. I'll clean my closet, organize my photos, and write follow-up thank you notes for gifts received eons ago. Soon, though, I do the one thing that always manages to get me unstuck, and that's head over to my bookshelf. There, I find a whole range of books, read and unread, classics and recent, sensible self-help books sitting alongside ambitious experimental works. Yes, there's no particular order or system. I just cram things where they fit. And it's the more daring books that always come to the rescue. I'll marvel at how Lawrence Stern had the guts to do what he did in Tristram Shandy, or how Machado de Assis dared to dedicate a novel to the worms devouring his dead narrator's flesh. And then it's back to work for me. And recently, I got to talking about fearless books and how they can inspire us with today's guest.
I'm Jessica Hagedorn, and I'm a writer, and I'm very happy to be here with Will.
Jessica Hagedorn has written poetry, plays, multimedia works, and four novels, starting with Dog Eaters, which won the National Book Award in 1991, and which she would later adapt into a play. Among her works are Toxicology, Dream Jungle, and a collection of poetry and prose called Danger and Beauty.
I grew up in Manila, the Philippines, and immigrated to the United States when I was 14. In Manila, I do remember, I have vivid memories, my childhood of moving from one house to another, but the house I really, really grew up in and think of as my real home was this wonderful old house in a section of Manila that's really changed now, but at the time was very serene and old, and sort of old Manila, and had survived the war, World War II, that is. And the house was very old and haunted, I think, and a great place to grow up.
But it wasn't just ghosts that filled her childhood home. It was a vibrant place for her family to gather, too.
Well, my immediate family wasn't large. I had two brothers, older brothers, but I had lots of cousins and aunts and uncles. My father had a lot of siblings. So big family in that sense.
Jessica spent childhood days listening to and learning from members of her community.
We did not have a television until I was 10 or 11 years old. Everybody had books in the house, and we had books and storytelling. Filipino culture is very extravagant emotionally, I feel, and storytelling, even when people gossip, it's always a big, you know, it's a performance.
When she wasn't swapping stories, she was reading them.
Oh, I had a very old copy from my older cousin of Grimm's Fairy Tales. And I was completely fascinated. They're scary, those stories. And I was really riveted by Hansel and Gretel. I thought, how could that old lady want to cook those children? I mean, it was so macabre. So weirdly Filipino, that sort of grisly aspect.
But this rich family life would soon change dramatically.
my parents separated, and it was very stormy breakup, and she did the grand exit like the diva she was. And, you know, it caused a lot of upheaval in our lives. And none of us knew it was coming.
Jessica and her siblings left the Philippines for the United States with their mother.
When we moved to San Francisco when I was 14, we immigrated. It was very different circumstances and quite painful, actually. I moved to this high school in San Francisco, and I had no idea what to do. It was a public high school, and I had gone to an all-girls school in Manila and had lived a very rather cloistered life, very lively, but cloistered in the sense of school. And suddenly I was in this co-ed environment, and the beautiful thing is, it was the 60s, and my mother had just by chance rented a flat in the Haight-Ashbury. So I learned to adapt quite fast, probably to her chagrin, but it was difficult. I'm making light of it now, but it was difficult, and I had to sort of really be observant and figure out what was going on around me and how do I survive this.
It took her some time before she could begin to process how much these events had affected her.
Well, I was taking an acting workshop for teenagers. I remember the teacher was very kind, but she tried to have me reveal something of myself through an exercise, and I wouldn't do it. I just sat there like a stone. And finally she said, well, okay, you can just sit there as long as you want. You don't have to say anything. And about 20 minutes went by, and I remember I just started to weep. And I did not understand why. And she knew, of course. There was a lot of pain there, and she didn't know why.
The timing couldn't have been better for someone pivotal to enter Jessica's life and change how she saw this new city and herself.
I met my mentor, my first real incredible mentor, who was Kenneth Rexroth.
Kenneth Rexroth was a central figure in San Francisco's cultural renaissance following World War II and one of America's most acclaimed and influential poets.
He lived a few blocks away from us, where my mother and I lived, on Fell Street, and he lived on Scott. And someone we hardly knew sent him some of my poems, and he read them, and he called me up. It was one of those bizarre things that never happened today. And he, you know, wanted to talk about my poetry. I mean, this man was a busy man. I had no idea who he was. And there was no Google or anything. So I had to sort of ask around. And I remember my English teacher said, what do you mean you don't know who he is? So it was an incredible relationship. I don't know what would have happened if I never met him, because he took me to City Lights. He took me to
City Lights, the bookstore
the first time. And I just thought, oh my God, this is like the life. I could be in Paris.
Rexroth helped foster Jessica's love for literature.
Oh, I read everything. I mean, I read Lolita. I read Catcher in the Rye. It's sort of anything I could get my hands on. Giovanni's Room. Anyway, I was not critical of anyone. I was just like this hungry reader, you know, wanting to know more. And I started imitating all the different poets, and sort of trying to find my own voice. But it took Kenneth, with his savvy and his sort of discerning taste, to turn me on to poets who really, really were like a revelation to me. I mean, poets from all over the world and writers like Baldwin. Oh, and then he had an incredible library in his home. And he said, anytime you want, just come over here and borrow. Just be sure you bring it back. He had, you know, the French Surrealists, all that stuff, Rimbaud, all that stuff. And he would tell me about them.
The more she read, the more she felt she needed to seek out a new storyline for herself.
I moved in with friends as soon as I graduated from high school. You know, I sort of really wanted to have that adventure, not to my mother's, you know, happiness. She wasn't thrilled, but what could she do? I was of age, you know, and I moved out. And I wanted to be a poet, and I wanted to do this and that and paint and, I don't know, just, I was an idiot on some level, like, and be free. But also I wanted to pursue my own life. What did that mean? It was such an incredible moment, I think, for a lot of young people, and also women trying to discover who they were, because suddenly you're given this weird sense of, probably false sense of independence. And there were a lot of ideas floating around in the air and the culture, and things were just happening so fast. And coming from the Philippines, where women are expected to, A, get married, and if you want a career, well, that's okay, but the family comes first.
Her poetry began to evolve after she left home.
I got more and more into figuring out how to not just read the work in public, but perform it somehow. And I connected with a group of dancers, musicians, theater artists who were very open about collaboration. I didn't even know that word, you know, and I was very young, but I went to see everything.
Soon, she was ready to try experimenting with another form.
In the back of my mind, I always knew one day I wanted to write a novel, whatever that meant, that the poetry would somehow not be able to contain all the stories in my head. So all that work that I was doing in San Francisco helped pave the way for why I decided to move to New York in the 70s.
When we get back from the break, Jessica comes into her own as a writer and later discovers a novel that will remind her why she chose this path.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When Jessica arrived in New York, she quickly found an apartment on the outskirts of the West Village.
It was cheap, believe it. It was, you know, all the way down near the highway. Nobody wanted to live there. It was really desolate. But there were three of us who came from San Francisco. My housemates at the time said, well, if you're going, we'll go too. And it was kind of the spirit of, let's just move and do it and try it.
To pay the bills, she took all sorts of odd jobs.
I answered phones. I worked in a store, Capizio, in the village off of 8th Street. I love that store. And actually, I worked there for 2 years. That's long for me. While I was doing, I had a band, and I performed, and everybody'd come, including the boss.
Bruce Springsteen. Or the boss of the store.
The boss of the store.
Ah, okay.
Although Bruce Springsteen used to come into the store because he was seeing somebody who worked in the store.
Her busy days left little time to write.
But at night, late at night, if I wasn't out listening to music or when I came home, that's when I wrote.
Jessica took advantage of those quiet hours to begin what would become her critically acclaimed and award-winning novel, Dog Eaters.
That was the book in my head that I thought one day I should write. And in the 70s, you know, Garcia Marquez was translated into English. And a friend from Mexico had given me the paperback of 100 Years of Solitude when I was still living in San Francisco. And I read it then, and I took it with me. I still have that tattered paperback. And I took it with me to New York, and I read it again and again. And also, I got turned on to Manuel Puig, you know, the wonderful writer of Kiss of the Spider Woman and all those other wonderful books. And I thought to myself, in a way, this sounds like my family. And the chances those writers took with the way they wrote fiction showed me the many ways you could tackle telling a big story. You know, that it didn't have to be rigid and that it didn't have to be linear.
These beloved works gave her the courage to tell a story set in and about the Philippines as only she could.
It was very difficult, the path to publication, because I think the novel, Dog Eaters, is not written in a traditional form. And there was also very little interest in the Philippines, or actually in that part of the world. It got so bad, everybody turned it down, that I told my agent, don't even call me unless you have anyone who says, yeah, maybe this could work. You know, there were people who wrote very thoughtful responses, but they would say, well, if only, you know, she could write it in a much more straightforward. But the Philippines is not straightforward. It's chaos, you know, and it's complicated, and it's funny, and it's sad, and it's huge. So one morning he called and he said, there's this editor who is really intrigued.
Soon after Dog Eaters was published, it landed on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, and everything changed.
Some of the same people who turned it down suddenly got real nice. It was a strange lesson. It was ironic. But it was a good one for me because I realized, well, wow. You know, I was really glad I trusted my own instincts and kind of kept believing that this book had to be written in the way it was written. I didn't want to change. I mean, of course it needed work, but I didn't want to change the voice.
And then she discovered Chilean author Roberto Bolaño.
I had read Bolaño's The Savage Detectives, of course, when it was first translated into English and everybody was talking about it.
Jessica would go on to read other Bolaño works like Amulet and Distant Star.
There was something so bittersweet and kind of earnest and idealistic, and at the same time, also very wise about his voice as a very young poet. And it was touching. And the things he believed in, his ideals, were very touching to me. And, you know, the Latin American struggles that he went through were similar to what was going on in the Philippines. And, of course, Chile and the Philippines had the same martial. I mean, it was like everybody had a dictator that was related, you know, or something. I mean, really, like you were going, were they all plotting this at the same time, you know? And so I became totally riveted by just the way his mind worked. His rigor, at the same time, his incredible sense of humor, and the way he believed in writers.
But it was his posthumously published novel, 2666, that would have a particularly big impact on Jessica and her work.
I think it was the masterful way he told this huge story. It just blew me away, the mastery of it. You know, from this sort of innocuous first section about the intellectuals, quite funny, and their search for this obscure writer, you know, which parts of it I thought, what the hell am I reading? And then this very violent section comes up with the academics, which literally took my breath away. It was so unexpected. And then I said, uh-oh, okay.
She came across 2666 during a difficult period in her life.
I was reading it in at a time when I was supposed to be writing my last novel, which ended up becoming Toxicology. And that title is connected to the dark material I was reading. There was a lot of upheaval in my life personally, and I was really sort of at this crossroads of, do I ever want to write again?
Bolaño's novel helped show Jessica a way forward.
And, you know, I trust him as a writer. I trust Bolaño as if he were my... I think when you love a writer, they are like your best friend. It inspired me to want to continue writing.
She got a chance to teach 2666 in a course at Long Island University as part of the MFA program she was directing.
I had these wonderful graduate students. A lot of them were working class, and they were coming to a lot of the books fresh. They didn't come from privileged backgrounds. And so I was asking myself a lot of questions about privilege. And even though I had had, you know, to struggle for a lot of my own grown-up life, I still had been privileged to have a supportive mother, to have, you know, books around me and things like that. All my life. These are things that I just took for granted.
Through her students' eyes, Jessica came to appreciate the novel even more.
There's a section called The Part About Fate, which takes place in Detroit, and it does not... It's an imagined Detroit. And then it goes to Mexico, of course, where he really knows the terrain. And, you know, my students were like, wow, he shouldn't write about the Black Panthers and blah, blah, blah. He doesn't know what he's doing. And I said, no, it's so touching. It's so touching.
What makes it touching?
Because he attempts it. And you can feel the sincerity in his attempt to write about it. There's so much hesitation these days. Even amongst my students, I remember they always felt like they could only write about what they knew.
She passes along to the next generation the lessons she took from Bolaño's fearlessness.
What I try to share with younger artists, not just writers, is you have to not be afraid. You have to try it. It's our job. And do your homework while you're at it. You know, but don't squash your imagination. I mean, my imagination is all I have, you know. Really. I mean, it's unique to me, unique to you, unique to my students. You know, they have their own vision, and they have to learn to trust it.
But That's Another Story is produced by Christy Westgaard with help from Kate Hines. Thanks to Jessica Hagedorn. If you'd like to learn more about the books we've mentioned in this week's episode, you can find out more in our show notes. You can also find a transcript of this episode and past ones on LitHub. If you've been enjoying the show, please be sure to rate and review on iTunes. It really helps others discover the program. And subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If there's a book that changed your life, we want to hear about it. Send us an email at anotherstory@macmillan.com. I'm Will Schwalbe. Thanks so much for listening.